This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Some 80 years ago, as farmers and conservationists watched our rich agricultural lands being lost to agricultural practices of the day, a new vision, a land ethic, was introduced to guide the development of practices that would preserve the land for future generations. Wisconsin's Aldo Leopold is among those credited for introducing that land ethic, and the Coon River Valley of western Wisconsin's Vernon County became an example of how old practices could be turned around to better preserve our land. Today, nearly a century later, our attention is increasingly focused on water, its perceived abundance, its growing scarcity, its threatened quality, and a growing discussion on water ethics that inform not only public policy, but also our daily use of water and what it all means for the future. Nearly 100 scholars, professionals, and students participated in a two-day conference on water ethics this spring at Viterbo University. Sponsored by Viterbo's Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership and the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters, the discussion attracted attendees from coast to coast and Canada, as well as from around the La Crosse area. One of the things growing out of the conference, expected to be available in just a couple of weeks in the month of November, is a fairly comprehensive web-based collection of materials that delve into the issues in greater detail. It's not just a who's who introduction to those who spoke at the conference, but will include conference handouts, videos of selected presentations, audio interviews with several participants, and a newly produced documentary featuring conference presenters. More on the site and how to find it later in this hour. This week's edition of Newsmakers is the first of two shows offering perspectives on a water ethic, featuring several presenters from the conference. We begin with international environmental journalist, educator, and author Cynthia Barnett. She was the conference's keynote presenter. Her two most recent books are Rain, A Natural and Cultural History, published in April, and Blue Revolution, Unmaking America's Water Crisis, which calls for a water ethic for America. That book was named by the Boston Globe as one of the top 10 science books of 2011 when it was published. She observes that while few would argue against the significance of water in our lives, most of us aren't consciously paying attention to emerging water issues, because we live with an illusion of water abundance, and no more so than here in the upper Midwest.
Yeah, so when we think about what is it, you know, when water is so essential to our lives and everything we do, how could it be that we treat it so poorly? It just doesn't make any sense at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one conclusion I've come to over time is that we have this illusion of abundance. We have this vision of abundance that is not really true. So, you know, just take, for example, the lawn. I interviewed a NASA scientist for Blue Revolution who had used satellite imagery to see how much of the nation is covered with irrigated turf grass. And it was an area larger than most states. In Blue Revolution, I call it our 51st state. People have this idea that there's plenty of water all the time to do everything we need and everything we want, when in fact, many of those areas covered with turf grass have suffering aquifers underneath, plummeting groundwater levels underneath. But we can't see down into the aquifer. We can see the beautiful green grass and we can see the lawn sprinklers. And, you know, turning the tap is the same way. When we turn on the tap in the kitchen or in the hose outside, out comes this abundant, extremely clean water. And the problems really have been hidden. We don't understand when we turn that tap that came from a natural source somewhere. We aren't thinking about, you know, the aquifer where it came from that might be stressed, or the river that it came from that might have been diverted. Mm-hmm. We don't think about how many miles it traveled, and we don't think about the energy that it took to heat it and all of those things. So that's what I mean when I say illusion of abundance. And I think it's particularly true in Florida, where I live, and in Wisconsin, where you live. These are, you know, water-rich states, right? And yet in Florida, we have extreme both quantity and quality problems. And here in Wisconsin, you've got a lot of water quality issues. So you look around and you see beautiful fresh waters everywhere you look, but you can't see some of the trouble going on in that water. So that's
what
I mean.
So the illusion is somewhat more pronounced in these areas where we're surrounded by water.
But I think we even have, we definitely have the illusion of abundance in the arid West too. You know, you go to the West and you see swimming pools and fountains and green lawns. So we still have that illusion in the United States, even in arid places. And it's a strange thing.
You talk about how raising our awareness to the realities will be or is perhaps currently being triggered by some sort of cataclysmic event. We're very mindful of what's been going on in California, which you say is really America's drought, not just California's drought. But is this something that you think is really finally grabbing people's attention, waking us up?
I think we're waking up for a couple of reasons. In the West, it's drought. It's the dramatic drought that we're seeing pictures of on the news. But here in the East, I think it is the water quality crisis. It is really worsening. And again, we had this period of 40 years since we passed the Clean Water Act. You know, a lot of rivers have been cleaned up. A lot of lakes have been cleaned up. Seagrass is restored, wetlands restored. But lately, it seems to me that there have been many more, outbreaks of harmful algae, for example. So in Florida, where I live, and in Ohio, we've seen, pretty serious outbreaks of harmful algae that are sort of waking people up to say, wait a minute, you mean I just was told I can't drink my tap water, and that's shocking. And, again, seeing those people on television waiting in line for fresh water when they live in one of the most water-rich regions of the whole world, I think that has been shocking. Seeing some of the pollution that we're seeing in Florida along the coast with red tides and algae in the springs, that's been shocking to a population that got used to having pretty clean water and seeing things cleaned up in a generation. And so I think on both sides of the country, quality and quantity scares are kind of bringing people together in a way we haven't seen in 40 years. Definitely, in the early 70s, before the Clean Water Act, before creation of the EPA, people were very upset, right, about water pollution. They were really upset about dams. They came together on those things. I really think we're going to start seeing that kind of interest that we haven't seen in a generation.
I want to come back around to a couple of things that you've touched on. The algae concerns people's drinking water and being able to consume it. But closer to home in Green Bay, for instance, and much closer to home, even in the backwaters of the Mississippi Valley, much of this affected by water levels, but also by climate concern issues and things that are changing. So there's that part of it as well.
Right, absolutely. It's not just drinking water. And the other health issues, some people have allergies to these kind of algaes, either from breathing it or having it touch the skin. And you're right, it's a combination of things. It's not only the agricultural runoff, but that's part of it. It's all of us. It's the runoff from our car parking lots and our roads and our agricultural practice, but it's also a warming world. So it's climate change too. As these waters warm, scientists fear that we're going to see more of this.
And it's not just the effects on human beings either.
Absolutely.
We know in the river areas, for instance, the way that this is affecting other vegetation and aquatic life. It's all connected.
Yes, it's all connected. That's very true.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. My guest is environmental journalist, author, and educator Cynthia Barnett, who set the stage for a series of discussions at this year's conference on water ethics at Viterbo University. Appropriately so, you'd said, because an emerging water ethic arguably has its roots right here in Wisconsin and the works of Aldo Leopold.
I think it absolutely has roots in the work of Aldo Leopold. It has roots in the American Dust Bowl because, you know, it was some of those emergencies that led Aldo Leopold to articulate this vision of living, you know, living better with the soil. And encompassed in the land ethic was an ethic for water, too. He talked about, as you said, how we're all connected, the land, the water, the soil, the creatures. Luna Leopold really took that forward in his career.
Luna being the son of Luna, Aldo Leopold.
Yes, Luna being the son of Aldo Leopold, and he's considered the father of modern hydrology. And he took that forward to articulate a water ethic for the nation. And unfortunately, we didn't listen to him at that time. Although many of the things he said we have done, but in 1977, he really said everything we ever would have needed to know about how differently we need to be living with water. We could be living so much differently with water without any pain whatsoever, and he knew that, and he tried to talk about that. That has evolved. Now, I think, to the need for a water ethic and more consciousness. It's really about consciousness and knowing what's really happening, knowing how your backyard hose is directly connected to an aquifer or a river. We're all, everything we do connects back to some natural water that you love in some other way. You may love it as your trout fishing spot or your swimming hole, and you're not thinking of it as your water when you're twisting the tap. You know what I mean? That's the disconnect.
Yes.
That's the illusion of abundance that's so strange.
You've said on several occasions that I've heard that it boils down to we need to learn to live with less versus finding more to meet our demands.
That's
right. We need to pollute less.
We need to.
Those two things.
Yes, yes. That is a really simple message. And, you know, now I've written 3 books about water. I've written countless articles about water. I've written white papers. I've given talks. I really think the only thing that needs to be said is that we can use a lot less and we can pollute a lot less. And that's exactly what the change needs to be. That is really what it comes down to. And it's eminently possible. So Americans are using less water all the time. We have been since the early 80s. Everything we do takes less water than it used to, from flushing a toilet to whatever industrial practice it is, takes much less than it used to. Ditto farming. Farmers are able to grow more crops per acre with less water, although not all of them are doing that now. And likewise, with fertilizers and pesticides, you know, we're able to use a little less, and that needs to become a lot less. But these are things that are possible.
To expand on that a little bit, of course, it's not just agriculture, it's not just
farmers.
Yes,
absolutely.
You reference, you know, people with lawns and
yes.
the runoff in driveways and
parking
streets
lots,
and parking
roofs.
Lots.
When you think yeah. about these big, dirty roofs are covering our cities, right? And when you think about all of that rainfall hits that roof, a lot of dirty stuff flows down, gets in the gutter, and flows down too, right along, you're right, with the agricultural runoff and the rest of it.
Which, while it's not necessarily taking away from the quantity of water that exists, mm-hmm. it's certainly taking away from the quality and therefore how we can use it.
Yes. So the odd thing about quantity is that water can vanish. I think that's another fallacy. You know, we're taught in school, water never disappears, right? There's this perfect hydrological cycle. So we're never going to lose any of it. And I think there's a false comfort in that because we know when you see a dried up spring or a dried up river, you know that we can lose a local water source. Yes, that water went somewhere, but it's no longer in your river. It's in a product or it's, you know, been transferred a couple hundred miles away. So I think there's almost a false sense of comfort in that hydrological cycle we learn in school.
When we're talking about a water ethic, as you've said, communities, mm-hmm. small communities, larger communities, however you want to define a community mm-hmm. of people, communities will define their own relative water ethics.
I think that's important. I think that's important because water is so local. Yes, it's a global issue, but my water issues where I live are very different from your water issues here. And there's so many positive things about keeping water local, right? For one thing, the longer we transfer water to another place, the more energy intense that is, the more it hurts the source of the water. There's a lot of reasons to think about water in a local way. And the analogy I would make is that to farmers markets. You know, when you travel in different areas of the country, you find wonderful new things in the farmers markets, depending on what's local and what grows in that region. And I think the water ethic will happen the same way. You know, in San Antonio, there's one sort of lawn ethic, and here there's going to be another because it's not so bad to water your lawn here. In Las Vegas, it will be another, and where I live, it will be another, and that's important. But we're at the same time, we're all in this together.
And I suspect it's going to shift even on a smaller scale.
Mm-hmm.
It's one way to think about it. In La Crosse, right adjacent to the Mississippi River,
yes,
versus being in a rural county 100 miles away from the Mississippi,
mm-hmm,
you're
mm-hmm.
still in a watershed of some sort,
yes.
But perhaps, water travels differently and,
yes.
and it's available differently. And so that
yeah.
could be a slightly different
yeah,
and ethical view.
That ethical view. And I think people who live adjacent to water also have this added, you've got this trust, you've got this responsibility of not letting bad stuff get in there that's going to go down to the Gulf of Mexico, right? So you've got this, it's almost like an added ethical dimension or a responsibility to live waterfront.
We talk a lot about it in terms of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to factor into this local water ethic angling, recreational opportunities and activities, commercial use of the Mississippi? It's
yes.
a huge transport. I mean, are those things that we factor into our
yeah.
local
yeah,
water
I think,
ethic?
I think those are essential. And the water ethic is really appealing to business people because using less and polluting less is also a lot cheaper. You know, the less chemicals you have to purchase to spread, the less water you have to purchase from a utility and then heat. I've met buildings operations managers who figured out how to save tens of thousands of dollars on their water bill by making some of the changes that we would think of as ethical changes, but they were good business decisions. So mm-hmm. the water ethic is also a smart business decision, as a lot of, you know, green building and other green practices are. And then, yes, on the angling, I think fishers traditionally have been some of the great caretakers of our waters. You know, fly fishermen, really helped stop the great dam building of the West in the 1970s. And these conservationists are some of our most important advocates for water and a water ethic.
We're talking with journalist and author Cynthia Barnett on this edition of Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Cynthia Barnett was the keynote speaker at the 2015 Water Ethics Conference held in April at Viterbo University. Her earlier books include Mirage, Florida, and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern U.S., and Blue Revolution, Unmaking America's Water Crisis. Her newest book is Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. So who do we look to for defining and championing a water ethic?
I think that's a really good question, and I would throw out universities first. I think when you look at, okay, let's look at Wisconsin and Florida again for the moment. Wisconsin and Florida state departments in my state, the state Department of Environmental Protection, in your state, the Department of Natural Resources,
yep.
These are two state agencies that have been told they can't talk about climate change when it is the biggest issue facing us. To me, that is a signal that government is not going to solve this problem at this time. That is a huge letdown, I think. So who can we look to in the dearth of, you know, being able to have our own government scientists be able to work on climate change and talk about climate change? I think universities would be the number one answer. There's a lot of leadership that can happen. Universities and colleges are really important. NGOs and nonprofit foundations. Billets Center in Seattle is the first big net zero water building in Seattle, which means it uses no water at all. It's amazing to read about net zero water and to see what some of these facilities can do. That was built by a major NGO that's headquartered in Seattle. And now I'm starting to get a lot more interested in churches, too. Churches, I think, are important to help spread the water ethic in so many ways. For one thing, a church is the kind of place where you can sit around and talk about ethics, and it's not weird the way it might be in a county commission meeting, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So that's a really natural place for this conversation to happen. And churches are full of people in the caring middle who really want to improve their communities.
But if these are places that can facilitate or host conversations on it, ultimately these need to be carried into those county commissioner meetings.
That's how this ethic happens. If there's a dearth of environmental leadership at the top, whatever the top is in your part of the world, what happens is that ethic trickles up from the grassroots, and that's how these things happen. That's how we've seen a lot of, you know, justice issues. It was that way with the civil rights era, right? There were some churches that made a lot of the earliest inroads in the movement, and also in integrating their spaces, and they did that, you know, while the government and the courts were still kicking and screaming. And sometimes these are places where progressive action can happen.
I also want to talk about your newest book, mm-hmm. which is called Rain, mm-hmm. A Natural and Cultural History.
Yes. So I've actually written a history of rain. It begins with the rains that filled the oceans 4.6 billion years ago and leads to the modern story of climate change. And I do get readers to climate change, but I get them there, you know, with a lot of fun stories, like the strange history of the Macintosh raincoat and a whole chapter on the scent of rain. I have a chapter called Writers on the Storm that's all about how rain has inspired literature. And so it started out as a new way to talk about climate change, but along the way, I just fell in love with the topic. So I've written a history of rain.
Well, as you point out, though, it also is a very unifying topic.
It is a unifying force. That's right. I think water is a really unifying force, and weather is, and rainfall is, because it's something that we all experience, right? And so rain does bring us together.
And how do we use rain as an entree, if you will, to this discussion of a water ethic? Is there a rain ethic that's part of that?
You know what? There are many ethical dimensions to rain. You know, this is a natural cleanser of the earth, right? One great detail in this book is that when you see a super blue sky, the bluest of blue skies happen after a good hard rain, because rain washes
cleanses
away
mm-hmm.
the pollution. And the same thing is happening in our aquifers, right? When the rain comes down and trickles back down into the aquifer, it gets nice and clean. And so that polluted stormwater doesn't run to the ocean and, you know, cause all kinds of havoc to fish there. And so I think green infrastructure, green building, rain gardens, all of those things are part of rain's angle to the water ethic.
You've summed up your comments saying that we need to live with water today that doesn't threaten it for future generations, or
that's right.
Along those lines.
Yeah. There's another way to define the water ethic that we live with water today in ways that don't jeopardize water for our children, ecosystems, and businesses tomorrow.
Cynthia Barnett is a Florida-based environmental reporter and educator. She's also author of several books, including Blue Revolution, Unmaking America's Water Crisis, and the recently published Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. She was in La Crosse to present at a conference on water ethics at Viterbo University in April of 2015, sponsored by Viterbo's Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership and the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. When we continue, we'll hear more about how the roots of a water ethic can be traced back to Wisconsin's Aldo Leopold, and even back to the Cooley region of southwest Wisconsin. If you missed part of today's conversation, you can hear audio archives of today's show at our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find links to extended interviews with our guests and more information about the Water Ethics Conference at Viterbo University. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.